Thank you. My name's Matthew, and I have alcoholism. What a great day, right? Let's hear it for the day, right? I mean, every speaker has touched on some aspect of this program, reminded me why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, Dennis did a really good job of working the steps and talking about the steps. And Mars did a great job of the progression of alcoholism. And our Al-Anon speaker, Keeley, was, you know, God bless you guys. And but how sick do you have to be to fall in love with us? And it's my only comment. And then Liz just talked about why staying in recovery and staying close to recovery changes your life. You know, I do want to say on Liz's behalf, she had 27 great years with the man she loved. It wasn't all cancer and illness. It was love, and that's why it's so hard. 28, sorry. Chipped you out of a year. My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993, and which is amazing to me. I didn't expect to live past 30, and let alone get 31 years of sobriety. I really didn't. I was in the live fast and die hard kind of group. And but I want to say before I start into what I was like is that, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it for so many reasons. And I've been really blessed with a lot of grace in my life that I've never drifted from AA. I know that's not everybody's story. I don't think it's because of my own volition. Certainly my feet went certain places and my car drove certain places, but I was really guided by some great people. And I was saying to Mike, thanks to the Mikes for taking care of me, and thanks to the Nicolene group here. For being so putting this together. But there is real enthusiasm in here. You know, I've been listening to you guys, listening to the speakers, and I know this is not a Southern Baptist enclave, right? But I'm hearing like, amen, yeah, that's all right, hallelujah, me too. And, you know, like, wow, I'm from behind me. And but I love that, right? Because, you know, I said to Mike, I go, they're enthusiastic. He goes, you know, they're glad to be sober. Our lives have been saved, right? And I don't, I get the opportunity to do this a lot, and I can tell you, I don't know if I've ever, I've been on the road for AA for 23 years, I think, and I don't know if I've ever really described what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you can't touch it. It's like trying to describe love. You can't, it's like trying to describe the wind, right? You can point at the trees. So we're stuck with these stories, and I don't want to talk about a lot about what I was like. There aren't a lot of people in their first year. How many people are in your first year here? Okay. All right, so just for you, May 16th, 1993 is my sobriety date, and I'm going to start with May 1st, okay? Because I had a long road of wreckage and all that, but I think I can do this that way. But, you know, I could come up here and say, you know, in May I had warrants out for my arrest, and I owed everybody money, and nobody was speaking to me, and I drank myself out of the greatest job in the world. I was a rock and roll musician touring all over for years, and I had all these, you know, circumstances, and people think our circumstances are our problem, and that's not why I'm qualified to come up here and speak. I have alcoholism. And just for you in your first year, you know, what that looked like is I didn't want to drink anymore. I really didn't, and I kept doing it. I really, in my heart, wanted to stop, and all of the good reasons to stop just blew right past me. You know, when I got fired from my last band, where my reputation was just ruined, you know, I had tried to stop. I loved that job. I practiced all my life for that job. I got God-given talent for that job, and I knew I was going to lose it because I couldn't stop drinking. I always went off with the fun people, you know. They seem like a better deal than the bus, you know. But, you know, and I didn't stop then. My mother, who I love dearly, I always feel like you're a little bit like of a rookie alcoholic if your parents loved each other and stayed married. You know, I'm not from a broken home. You know, I wasn't raised by wolves. You know, I was raised by golden retrievers. My parents were like, what do you want? What do you want to do? What do you want to do? You want to play guitar? Like they were nice to me, you know. They really loved me. They really did. And I didn't want for anything. I certainly didn't want for love. Now, I always like to say I'm alcoholic, and that's not my parents' fault. I'm Irish Catholic. That's their fault, right? But I love my mother, And when my mother got diagnosed with, I love that laugh. You can come sit right here, baby. But when my mom got diagnosed with cancer, I wanted to stop drinking because they didn't know. I went away. I come from a long line of alcoholics, and my parents are not alcoholics. My brothers are both alcoholics. I'm the youngest in an Irish Catholic family. And my grandfather, I found out on my dad's deathbed, was an investment banker in the 30s. And he died of alcoholism after Bill Wilson 12-stepped him. Yeah, that's what I said. My dad's laying there, and he goes, I don't know what it, my dad knew the guy that started your club. And I don't know what he's talking about. And I go, he's in his hospital bed in the living room. And I go, what club? He goes, AA. And I go, what? And he said, Bill Wilson? And I'm like, Dad, I've been sober for 15 years. You're telling me this now? You know? And he never explained. Yeah, that was it. He said he came over and tried to help my dad, my grandfather. And I didn't know my grandfather's name because we were ashamed of him. He died of alcoholism in 1945. I didn't know his name until I was a grown-up. But I loved my mom. I wanted to quit. I had to come home from the East Coast where I'd ruined my career, and I lied. I told everybody I came home because my mother was dying of cancer, you know. I just thought that made me look better. I came home because I had nothing left, you know. But in May of 1993, I wanted to stop drinking because I was really sick all the time. I was just like, I could watch myself put poison in me and watch what it did to my body, and I didn't want to do it anymore. But what it looked like, what alcoholism looked like for me, because we talk about being powerless, we talk about the way the book describes it, but the way it looked like for me is I had this really beautiful apartment by the beach. It was really convenient because I hadn't paid rent for a while, so it was real super cheap, you know. I never answered the door because the bad guys are coming, but the ocean was like where that back window is. And the only reason I knew that is because I could hear it. I never saw it because I would have had to leave my apartment to do that. But I'd sit in this apartment. I'd wake up. Let's talk about a day in May of 1993. I'd wake up, and honestly, my first thought, I'd say out loud, don't drink. Don't drink today because I'm so sick, you know. And that's alcoholism, right? Because I'd say, don't drink today, and then I'd agree with him. I go, yeah, we shouldn't do that, you know. There's only me, and we're talking out loud now. You know, every time I drive by a homeless person, he's talking out loud. I'm like, I get it, man. You know, nobody else is listening. Let's just talk to us. So I wake up in the morning, and I don't want to drink. I really don't want to drink. You know, my mom lives 2 miles away. She's dying of cancer. I can't get a job. There's a girl across town that's pregnant with my child. I'm 31 years old. She's 18. Pfft. Like I care what you think of me. Let's context. I'm speaking at an AA meeting. Oh, he got a girl pregnant. No, she got herself pregnant. Yeah. Men in AA date magical women. And magical women make themselves pregnant and ruin our lives. Yeah. I know. It's all right. All the women hate me now. I'm used to that. It's okay. But these are my circumstances that I think are my problem. I think these are my problem. This is my problem. And I walk down the hall. Maybe I go in the bathroom. I'm not drinking. We decided that together, me and I. And maybe I get in the shower that day. I didn't always do that. I lived alone. I didn't entertain. So I didn't shower every day. But I get in the shower maybe. This is a typical day. And, you know, you turn that hot water on. I don't know about you guys, but you know, when that hot water hit me, I'd feel like 8% better. And that's starting to get dangerous. I was terrible. I'm sick. I'm a loser. No one loves me. I have no money. I get in the shower. I'm not drinking. And now I'm getting clean. And I feel like, oh, hold on. And there's some shampoo left kind of I scrape out of the bottom of the soap dish. And now I'm clean and I'm a good man because I'm not going to drink. And then a thought would happen. Typically at that time, honestly, the thought would be go visit your mother, go visit mom. I love my mom. And one of the reasons I was a musician is because my mom, I went to a small Catholic school in Redondo Beach. And, you know, if you went to those kind of schools, they're not fancy. They're a little scary. You know, we had nuns for teachers and my friends called them the witches of God. You know, they got there like, you know, like It's weird. And I would think my mom did yard duty one day when I was in seventh grade, and I had good friends. I grew up with the same. I'm still friends with my friends from Catholic school. I still have the same five best friends. And my mom came home from school, and I was sitting there, and I had headphones on. I love music. I love music so much. And she tapped on the headphones, and I took them off, and she said, "You don't get picked first for the team, do you, baby?" And I go, "I don't care about that stuff, Mom." And I didn't. I'm competitive, but not like that. And she said, "But, you know, you don't do stuff like, you don't play the sports." I go, "I play. I just don't, you know, I don't like that. I don't care about it, right?" And she said, "Do you want to play an instrument?" And I almost came flying out of that rocking chair. I said, "I want to play the guitar." Like, I loved Eric Clapton. I love Steve Howe from Yes. It's still kind of a god, like, to me. And George Harrison, this melodic. I just listened to music. All I could hear was the guitar. And I said, "I want to play the guitar, Mom." And she had a funny look on her face. And she goes, "Okay." And I had a guitar, like, 3 hours later. And seventh grade. And we ate soup for a couple weeks. And I'm not particularly attentive to Catholic holidays, so I thought maybe it was Lent, you know. I don't know, why are we eating soup? And because she spent the money for the food on my guitar. I didn't know that for years. But this is the woman that lives 2 miles away, and I'm dying of alcoholism, and she's dying of cancer. And in the shower, I'd say, "Go visit Mom." So now I'm clean, I'm not drinking, and I'm a decent person. And I've been up for 20 minutes. That's what my day looked like. But there's this thing we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in the book. It's in one of the first prayers in the book. It's called The Bondage of Self. I love that phrase. It's meant so much to me in my recovery. And it really, I could understand it. And I didn't understand a lot of the book when I first read it. But I've noticed over the years, for me in sponsoring people and paying attention to people speaking, is, you know, there's symptoms of the bondage of self. And one of the symptoms, the big symptom, is fear. If I'm in fear, I'm usually in the bondage of self. You know, we talk in AA about self-centered fear. That's the only kind of fear alcoholics fear. I don't worry about you, you know. I worry about me. And at least at that time. So what looks like is I'm getting out of the shower, and suddenly I think, wait, what does Mom know and what does Mom not know? Does she know I got fired from that restaurant I managed? Does she know that there's a teenage girl pregnant across town? Does she know I don't play music anymore? Because I don't know, partly because if you'd held a gun to my head and said, "When did you last visit your mom?" I would have said, like, 3 weeks ago. I hadn't been there for 7 months. But I used to call. Sometimes I guess I was loaded. Sometimes I was probably in that window where I wasn't. And I'd say, I'm gonna come see her. She was 2 miles from my house. And she always said the same thing. She said, "That would be lovely, darling." She didn't say, "You called yesterday." And I never went. And I adored her. But I step onto the bath mat, and I'm hearing in my head, like, wow, what do they know? And my mom and dad were very happy together and married and loving and kind. And I'm thinking, man, do they know about all the stuff? Do they know about the money? Like, I owe everybody money. Do they know about the police problems? And they still weren't sure why I left the East Coast. And so now I'm afraid. I'm in the bondage of self. And I wipe off that mirror, you know, and I'm shaving. And I was so sick of myself the last year of my drinking that I would just look in my eyes because I couldn't look at my face. And I'd shave looking in my eyes. And then I'd think, you know, I could go next door, get 2 beers, and honestly, that's not drinking. I'm not drinking, but I could go get 2 beers, kind of cool out. And the idea, honestly, if I'm being totally honest, is I would go over there, I could shuck and jive a little with Mom and Dad, find out maybe what they know, what they don't know, redirect the conversation. That's what I'm thinking when I'm looking in the mirror. And then I get scrape money together. I'm so ashamed. I like pawned my guitars. Like, I love my guitars, you know. I really do. I finally got back my first guitar that my mother bought me. But I would go next door to that liquor store, and I didn't dress for that, you know. I used to wear these OR scrubs to life. Not really to bed. Yeah. Just to whatever was happening, which was not much, you know. and we used to wear them over our bathing suits when we go surfing, but I just wore them, you know, and I'd have a t-shirt on with a hole in it because I thought I was Marlon Brando, you know, and I go next door to the liquor store, and as you're getting closer to two beers in the cooler, they get smaller and smaller. Like, have you seen two Coors lately? They're like little tiny, you know, like, that's not going to do it. And then I look right above them, and there's two Fosters. Now, the Australians know something about beer, right? It's Australian for breakfast, right? And so I get those two Fosters. Now, that's up my expenses a little bit. And I go to the liquor store counter. It was Mr. BJ's Liquor. I've been going there all my life since I was a little kid. And Mr. BJ lived to be 110, and he was behind the counter. And he would lower his glasses. He'd go, Matthew, you have a problem. And your problem is trying to convince you that you don't have a problem. And I'm like going, what are you, the Riddler? Just like, I just want to buy this. We did this yesterday. Like, this is not hard, you know. And then I'm looking over his shoulder, and there's a bottle of gin that costs exactly as much as these two Fosters. Not great gin, but I like gin because it works. But I'm not drinking. I'm really not. And I buy the gin and leave the, you know, I don't know why Mr. BJ thought I had a problem, but I would go home thinking, what's he talking about? I got so many problems. Like, he has no idea how many problems I have. And then I go in there and I sit there and I'm just going to have a little. And I'm going to go see my mother. And once I have that little bit, you know, I love that scene in Easy Rider when Jack Nicholson takes a hit off the bottle. He goes, nick, nick. I'm like, yeah, baby, I get that, right? You know, and I take the little hit off that gin, and you know the story. It's just not quite, I'm just going to have a little more, you know. And then I got to drink real fast because I got to forget that I'm going to see my mother today. And I did that day after day in some version of that. You know, and I love so many things. I have a degree in literature. I have a degree in comparative mythology. I love to read. I didn't read. I sat there drinking. I love to play music. I can play many instruments. I didn't play my instruments. They were disappearing off the wall. I like to surf. The ocean was right outside my back door. I didn't leave my apartment. You know, it just got so small. Being an alcoholic got so small. And that's what I love about what we've heard today. The spiritual experience and the spiritual path is inexhaustible. The alcoholic road gets smaller and smaller and is finite. The spiritual expansion that I've experienced in these rooms and in the adventures I've had with you people is continually expansive. It gets bigger every year. I love AA more today than I ever have. So that's what I was like. And what happened is my brother called. And my brothers, like I said, were alcoholics. My oldest brother, we didn't know so much. He moved away. He was a poet in San Francisco. Like, really a poet. He's very well respected. Seriously, who reads poetry? Like, my family and him, you know. But my other brother was kind of my hero. I'm the youngest. I was just surprised. I love Catholics not believing in birth control because I'm here. You know, like, forget all those unwanted pregnancies. I'm here. You know, that's how selfish I am. In fact, my dad and mom named me Matthew because Matthew means gift from God. Like, I didn't know that. And when I was in third grade, the nuns go, hey, okay, we're going to tell everybody what your name means today. And they go, Matthew, oh, your name means gift from God. And I go, oh, that's great. So I get home from school. My dad comes home from work. I go, Dad, my name means gift from God. And he goes, yeah, it was kind of marketing spin. And I have no idea what he's talking about. Like, so I think I'm marketing spin. I think that's cool. They were trying to make it feel good that they had a baby they didn't expect 7 years after my brothers and sisters were born. Like, what are we going to do with this guy, you know? But that brother was my hero, right? Because he was 7 years older. He did cool stuff, you know. He played the drums, looked like Paul McCartney. I loved that guy. And he was a raging alcoholic. He ruined my family life for years. And I told myself I was never going to be like him. And he called on May 8th, because May 9th was Mother's Day. And he said, hey, he was sober 12 years. And he said, hey, tomorrow's Mother's Day. And this is, I love this. He said, I know you're having car trouble. Because in my family, you know, we don't like to bring up controversial subjects, you know. And I'm like, I knew what he meant. Like, I had a car key, right? And it had the name of a car maker on it, but I hadn't seen the part that you plugged it into in a really long time. And in my family, that's car trouble. Like, we don't want to upset anybody, but that's car trouble. And what I didn't know was happening is that he knew I called mom and didn't come, and he didn't know why, because I hid from them. My brother wreaked havoc. He was like a wildfire in our life. I was gone away. I graduated with honors, topped my class. Then I went on the road with the band. They didn't hear from me. I'd send letters, postcards. We'd talk on the phone, but my brother said, tomorrow's Mother's Day. I know you're having car trouble, and it's going to be mom's last Mother's Day. And we got to make sure we show up for her, and I'm going to come get you. And all I heard was, it's mom's last Mother's Day? That can't be. You know, I wanted to see her a few weeks ago. I hadn't seen her in months. And he said, I'm going to come pick you up. Now, what I had planned to do was I was going to get some flowers. I would likely steal those because they grow naturally. And I don't have a lot of money. But I was going to write a card because it's a funny thing. When you get a degree in English literature and a degree in comparative mythology, you're qualified to write a card for your mom. It's like not a lot else, you know. You know, I've never had somebody go, hey, do you know a lot about Faulkner and Islam? We're looking for a guy like you. Like, there's not a career path. And so I'm going to write this card for my mom. I'm going to steal some flowers. I'm going to do the laundry. Because I wanted my mom to know before she died how much her youngest boy adored her. I wanted to blow her mind. I remember this call. I remember very clearly, like, what? I didn't know it was Mother's Day. I didn't know what day it was. But what did I do? I went next door to see Mr. BJ to make a plan. And I sat on that couch all night drinking. And he honked his horn for brunch. And I've been wearing the same clothes for a week. And I got a clean, like, I like that line from Chris Christopherson, I got my cleanest dirty shirt, right? I didn't have a clean shirt, but I tried, and I put my hand through my hair, and it was just like oil. It's like, you know. And I ran out there, and my brother looked up at me, and his jaw dropped. And I didn't know why. I mean, I didn't look that bad. And then I got in the car, and he was looking at me, and he was real weird, and I weighed 108 pounds. I'm 5'10". Well, I used to be, but I'm old now. And I weigh 160 pounds right now. So I don't know how I lived through that, but they weigh you in like a fish in rehab. And I found out later that I weighed 108 pounds. But he just looked at me. You know, this may not make sense to you guys, but I look like something out of Pirates of the Caribbean, you know. Not the movie, the ride, you know, like the that guy with the rags. And I don't know that. I think I'm okay. My clothes are dirty. I smell a little. And I want to hurry this up because I really want to talk about recovery. I ruined Mother's Day. And I don't know why. I never knew why I did that stuff. I never meant to do that stuff. I didn't mean to get thrown out of the band. I love those guys. They're my best friends. I just remember, I don't even know what happened. I saw her face. I saw my dad's face and how they were looking at me. I'd been drinking for a week. And my brother mercifully took me out of there. And you know, I never meant to do that. I never meant to be like that. I asked my sister on my 20th AA birthday, 20 years later, I asked my sister what happened. And she said, we will never speak of that. I loved my mother. So I tried to describe for you in the first year that alcoholism is I couldn't stop drinking, even when I wanted to. But the ugliness of the disease and the way it affects the family. And my mother loved me. I don't know what it felt like for her to see me come in there like that, looking like that, acting like that. She said, my sister said, all I'll say is you were vile. And I'm a decent guy. I love women because I love my mother and my sister. I respected them. I've always loved women, kind and respected them. My dad told me how to treat a woman. My parents' marriage was an example. Kindness and communication. And I pushed that 18-year-old girl down a flight of stairs when she was 8.5 months pregnant. That's what I became. And that's not where I came from. And I wasn't trying to hurt her. Like, that sounds so much, well, it's as bad as it sounds. But what happened was she came to the door, and I'd been drinking all night. And she said, hey, we have to go to the doctor today. maybe don't party today. And what I heard was, you're a bum. And she wasn't in the door yet, and I didn't want to go to the doctor, and I was pretty drunk, so I just pushed her out of the doorway. And I, you know that feeling when you know you did it a little too hard? And I saw her face, and I slammed the door. I saw the fear in her face because she was falling backwards. I lived on the second floor, and I ran in there and locked the door, and I just started drinking that gin, and I forgot all about her. So I ruined Mother's Day. And you know, we've talked a little bit about it today, and a lot of people have said very clearly and proudly, God, you know, God. We have a relationship with God, and I think God is a loaded word. It's a loaded word for me. I went to Catholic school. It was very carefully explained to me that God doesn't like me. You particularly, he doesn't like, you know. Then I was at dinner, you know, tonight, and I was saying, I remember I was in eighth grade. I was class president. Like, I was not a loser. I was into doing the good things. And this nun was looking at me. I was, what are you, 14 in eighth grade, 15? Like, the midst of hormone wars, right? And this nun looked at me and said, you know, if you're even thinking about sex, you're going to hell. And I went, Jesus, you know. I was saying earlier today, when I brush my teeth, I sometimes forget to think about it, but I usually try to keep on the topic in my head. I don't think I'm ever going to have it, like, but, you know, I'm 15 years old. And then I looked around the room and thought, well, hell's going to be super crowded. Because I know these guys, right? But I don't want to talk about God. I want to talk about grace. Because that's the wind in the trees, man. That's the evidence. And you don't know when grace is coming. I don't know. I don't know when I'm setting the wheels of grace in motion. And what happened to me, why I'm standing here, is on the way home to my apartment when my brother took me out of Mother's Day brunch early, we had a huge fight. Any other Irish Catholics here? How odd. Yeah. This is my, and you know, like, we fight, and it's like no big deal. I think like swans on a lake, like, oh, bah, bah, bah. See you at Christmas. Say hi to Mom. Like, we don't care. It's what we do, right? And we're yelling at each other. I have no idea what we're yelling about. But I got out of the car, and I slammed his door. And I had this thought. I go, I'm so sick of being the little brother. I'm sick of losing to that guy. I'm sick of him. You know, I grew up through his alcoholism, and he's arguing with me that, and this is alcoholism. I thought I had the moral higher ground. I just ruined Mother's Day. I ruined my dying mother's Mother's Day, and I'm going to win the fight. That's what I thought. And I didn't know grace was galloping at me. I didn't know. I went into my apartment. I paced around. I'm waiting for him to get home because he didn't live at the beach like me. He lived in Lawndale because, you know, he paid his rent. Whatever, right? I lived in a much nicer apartment, well beyond my means. And I had to wait for him to go to the lame newcomer part of town where my brother lives. And he called me, or I called him. I waited till he got home, and I called him, and he picked up the phone, and I just let him have it. And I'd love to know, I would love a transcript of that conversation. What could I possibly have said? But I can tell you, growing up with him was hard because I worshiped him, and he hurt my parents. You know, I had a paper route in Redondo Beach in the 70s, and the way that worked is you deliver 30 days of papers. Like, I had 57 papers on my paper route. I delivered 30 days of papers, and I collected the money from every one of those people, and some people won't come to the door when the paper boy is collecting. The $4 that it cost at that time for the paper. And then I pay the paper back, whatever those papers cost for a month, and then I get the rest, which was $30. I made $1 a day, and my brother stole it every month to go pay for his beer. You know how I got him to stop stealing it? I hollowed out my first communion Bible, and I put it in there because I thought no one in this family is going to look in my Bible. And I saved money and bought another guitar with that. But anyway, that's how he was. And I'm mad at him that he's yelling at me, and I'm yelling at him. And I go into my apartment. I call him up. I let him have it. I'm screaming at him. And he's not saying anything because it's not a dialogue. I'm going after him. And I ran out of steam, you know. And he said very quietly, after a minute of silence, he said very quietly, he said, Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. I'd heard that before. I'd heard that from band managers. I was engaged for like 20 minutes. And then I met this girl's parents and I'm like, walk with me, talk with me. Now, you're not marrying my daughter. And they would say stuff like, you have a problem with alcohol. And I go, no, my brother did. He lived in his car. I'm touring the world. I got 2 degrees. And my brother said, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. And I swear to God, God hit me between the shoulder blades and the truth came out of my mouth because I said, of course I do. And I was shocked that I said that. I wanted to fight and win, and he disarmed me. And I can tell you today, that was 31 years ago. I can tell you it was a beige phone. It had a cord down to the mothership for you young people. That's how they used to look, these giant bricks that if your parents would hit each other with if you had a different family than mine, and a green shag carpet. There were gin bottles all over the floor. And I think I can remember that moment. I could tell you what the air felt like. I could tell you what the room smelled like. I think I didn't have like a spiritual awakening. I think I just stepped into the present moment because I finally told the truth. And I'm standing there feeling this weird being present. I didn't feel a presence. I want to be clear. And then I said, of course I do. And my brother, he was so funny, he goes, don't go anywhere. I go, okay, you know. I haven't really gone anywhere since last year, but I was going to move to that end of the couch in the fall. But I'll just stay right here, you know. Like, don't go anywhere. And he lived a half an hour away, and my brother got there in 10 minutes. And I love him for that, right? Because what did we hear today? What's the number one ingredient? If you have 3 weeks or 2 years or 30 years or 50 years, willingness. And he heard it. He heard this little bit of willingness. It's the most precious ingredient we've got, no matter how long you're sober. And he raced to my house and ran it because he didn't want to miss the window. And my brother, I want to talk about recovery. I've got a half hour left, so I'm going to just tell you how he 12-stepped me. He walked in. It's so funny. I'm sitting on the couch. I thought he was going to come in, maybe punch me once, you know, because of what I've done all day. And I kind of hoped he would because I hated myself. But he came in and he inhaled and he goes, hey, let's go to the beach. It's like, it was ripe in there, man. Like, I had dishes in the sink from the Reagan administration, you know. I lived alone. I was a bachelor. And I didn't open the windows because a SWAT team might come tumbling through there. And you know, I'm like, what are we, like, we live like Gollum, you know, my precious, you know. Right? That's how I lived. Like, I walked around at night talking to myself. And my brother said, let's go to the beach. And I remember I grabbed a pack and a half of Marlboro Reds. I don't know why that's so important to me. But we went down to the beach, and we sat on this lifeguard stand. And, you know, I gave this talk a few years ago, and somebody went and took a picture of that lifeguard stand and sent it to me. Yeah, Avenue A. I don't need another picture, but Avenue A and Redondo. And he sat there, and he just looked at me, and I was shaking trying to light the cigarette because I was so afraid of him yelling at me. And he took the cigarettes, and he lit a cigarette and handed it to me. And he had quit smoking, and he lit a cigarette and smoked with me. He just wanted me to calm down. And then he was quiet for a while. I'm scared. And he looked up, and he started telling me how he felt when my mom and dad kicked him out of the house when he was 18 years old. And I was really surprised that he brought that up because I was 11 when that happened, and it was a dark day in our house. We didn't do that to our own, but he had earned it. And he told me how he felt that day, and I'm surprised by this. And then he told me how he felt when his wife and his son, he got his high school girlfriend pregnant, his wife and his son kicked him out of their house. And I was like 15 then. And he called me from a payphone. He had no one else to call. His little brother. My brother was the coolest guy I knew. Really smart in business. Great musician. And he was down to me. And he called me and he was sobbing into the phone. I said, why don't you quit drinking? Because I could see it was the drinking. But I'm 11 years old. I didn't have another drink for 7 years. And then he started telling me how he felt. Well, before the last one, he said, what's your plan? And I thought, God, he doesn't know that I owe everybody money. He thinks I'm the guy that went off to college. He doesn't know that that girl's pregnant. He doesn't know. And in the middle of it, I realized my life was unmanageable because I didn't think my brother would believe me if I told him the reality. And I just admitted I was powerless when I said, of course I do. So on May 9th, I worked the first step, and I didn't even know it. And then my brother started telling me how he felt when he lived in his car. And I remember that because I was about 17. I used to play with a band down in high school, and they gave me keys to the music room. And I'd ask my dad, can I borrow the car? I put my Fender Twin in the back, and I had a great Stratocaster. I still have that guitar. It's so beautiful. And I'd drive to school, and then I'd drop my stuff off, and then I'd drive around and try to find my brother's primer gray 52 Cadillac because that was his house. And I didn't understand it at the time. But what happened to me on the lifeguard stand is I thought, he's talking about how I feel right now. And that's what it says to do in the chapter Working with Others. It says, tell them a little bit about yourself and win their confidence. What I want to point out is it doesn't say thump them on the chest and call them stupid. And I've heard that in these rooms before. And my brother had done that a lot of my life. But he came armed with certain facts about himself and saw a man suffering from alcoholism. This book says not to do that, by the way. If your sponsor's doing that, they're not doing AA. And if he had done that, I'd be dead, because he did that all the time. I'd had lots of people shame me. So honestly, to tell you the truth, I ran out of cigarettes. So that's why I said I'll go to AA. It's like, he's still talking. I'm like, shit, I'm out of, what are we going to do now, you know? And I said, I'll go to AA. And my brother, he was so funny. He goes, oh, you're not going to AA. And I go, what? He goes, you're going to a hospital. Because I'm Pirates of the Caribbean guy, right? I don't know that. And I actually said, I go, what? I can't do that. I'm busy. Remember that? Like, I'm busy. I haven't gone to work in 8 months, you know. I haven't left the couch for except for emergency Mr. BJ moments forever. And I go, how long? And he goes, 30 days. I'm like, dude, I can't leave all this. What is wrong with us? Right? And honestly, not only had I almost killed my child the week before, I had a gun in my mouth 2 days ago. But I think going to the hospital is extreme. I'm like, let's not overreact. Like, I got this, right? So my brother ignored that. We walked up to the apartment. I was so embarrassed. I ran up the stairs, and he was walking down through the courtyard, and he goes, hey, buddy, don't die. And I was embarrassed because I thought he knew about the gun. And we didn't do that. We don't do that. I'm proud to be a Mitchell. I love my family history. I love my parents. I love what I was given. And when he said, don't die, I thought, he knows. Because, you know, we think they know. We think they can look at us and see how we see ourselves. He didn't know. He didn't want me to die before my mother. Because of her. And so what happened was, I forgot about my surrender to rehab because it took a while. And I want to say grace, right? That grace just showed up. I got in a fight and my brother came and 12-stepped me. Grace comes when you surrender a little, just a little. And my surrender was, of course I do. And then my next surrender was, okay, I'll go to the hospital. And the way that showed up in grace is a week later, he calls and says, we're going tomorrow. And I'm like, what? He goes, I'm going to pick you up tomorrow. So I drank all night. I wanted to get ready for rehab. I wanted to present the specimen that they were going to have to fix. Like, I didn't go, oh, good, we're going to rehab. I'm going to do some laundry, maybe fluff my clothes. Like, what? That was a week ago. I've changed my mind, you know. And so I passed out. I passed out standing up. You know how you know when you have the clues, like your head's wedged against the wall. And the phone's ringing on May 16th, my sobriety date. I pick up the phone thinking it's my brother. And it's this woman who said, your daughter was born. We've been trying to get you. But I don't answer the phone in the middle of the night because those are the bad guys. They've been calling all night. I've been drinking looking at that. Like, ooh, I'm not picking that up. And then it was this woman trying to get me to the hospital. And she said, can you come to the hospital? I'm going to hurry this up. I ran out and looked for my car. I had the key, and I was like, car, 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 you know. Running around in my hospital scrubs and my holy T-shirt and my flip-flops. And I found it. Grace, right? I found it. The better thing was it was an AMC, and it started. I didn't expect that. I got in the car. It started. I drove directly to the wrong hospital. You know, it's just so funny. I love the book. It says over and over, selfishness, self-centeredness, in many different ways. I drove to the hospital where I was born. Because that's where babies come from, you know. I mean, everyone knows that. Yeah. And, you know, all this grace, like, I went in there, and there was this candy striper who was, like, 90 years old. Not like the candy stripers from the porn movies, like the real candy stripers. Like, I expected something different, and I went in there, and I'm yelling at her about, like, look again, you know, and I look like a skeleton from Pirates of the Caribbean, and she's like, they're not here. And I walked out of there, and, you know, they talk about moments of clarity in AA, and they act like they're good things. And I'm standing out there, and I just recently, last year, I went to the Getty Museum in Malibu, and I saw this vase that it's so thin, this paper thin glass vase, and it's been around since before Christ. And that moment when I walked out there, it was like I took that vase, and it was my life. It was all the gifts I got. It was the character building my father gave me. It was the talent that God gave me. It was the love and understanding that my mother gave me. It was all the opportunities I got, and I smashed it on the ground. That's what it felt like. And I'm looking at this asphalt that's glittering anyway, and I'm seeing all these tiny little pieces of glass, and I know I'm never going to fix that. That was the clarity I had. I'm not going to fix that. So I decided to shoot myself. And it wasn't for a good reason. I'd love to say, it's like, I don't want to torture anybody anymore. And I just wanted out. I'm a coward. I really am. Then I didn't have any tools to understand my fear. And I got in that car, and I put my head in the steering wheel, and I'm sobbing. And I start the car, and it bucked. It backfired, and my head bounced off the steering wheel, and the name of the right hospital came into my head, and that is grace. It is grace, right? Let's hear it for grace. And you know how I know it's grace? Because I meditate every day. I practice meditation. And how many of you meditate regularly? It's about half of you guys that raised your hands. Okay, so when you meditate for 10 minutes a day for 3 days, what's the first thing you find out? You're not in charge of the thoughts that come into your head, right? I was in Australia last year, and I was meditating before a talk, and Carla Rojo came into my head. Carla Rojo wouldn't go to a dance with me in eighth grade. I'm 62 years old, and I'm in there going, yeah, screw you, Carla Rojo. You know, that's how random our thoughts are, right? We're not in charge of them. I was not trying to think of the name of the right hospital. I had an involuntary electrical impulse go across my brain and fed me some grace and said, go there, don't go there. And I did. I think that's God. And I went to the hospital. I ran up there. I ran in the room, and Anna got out of that bed. Have you ever seen a woman that's just had a baby? Oh, yeah. Not good. Yeah. Again, I've already alienated you, but I didn't love her anyway. And she got up, and she looks like the Elephant Man, and she's got like her hair's matted to her, and she's glad to see me, and she's coming at me, and I'm afraid that she's gonna hug me. And as she got closer and closer and closer, I thought, my God, something is beautiful about her right now, and I didn't like it. I didn't not like it. I felt gross. She had just given birth to a baby, and she had a life in her that I'd never seen. She didn't look physically good, but she had something going on, and it humiliated me because I'm in the bondage of self. And when you're in the bondage of self, you don't know. And then she reached into this box. She didn't hug me, thank God, and she handed me Phoebe Rose. And Phoebe Rose was stunning, and I wanted to throw up. Because I'm not part of this world. I don't even know. One of the things I think about when I'm in the bondage of self, we talked about this the other night about walking across a room. When I'm in the bondage of self, I just paint everybody with my interior ugliness so that I can maneuver through the room. And these two women were so authentic, Phoebe and Anna, my paint would not stick. My game did not fly. And I just wanted to get out of there. I said to Anna, I was in there for 45 seconds. I said, Anna, everything's going to be all right. The first thing I said in front of my daughter was a lie. And I handed the baby back, and I ran down the stairs, and I knew I was going to kill myself. It was very clear and I actually said a prayer. I said, God, make it so those two women never see me again, as I ran out the back door of that hospital, drove home, ran up the stairs, and my brother's standing on my porch with a duffel bag. Grace, grace, grace. We're freaking swimming in it. We really are. You know, right? Like, I couldn't make that happen. I went to the wrong hospital, then the right hospital. I didn't stay long. He's been in my apartment trying to find some clothes because I'm not home. He doesn't know why I'm not home. All of us have had this grace. You're probably thinking about it right now, right? Like if this is a regular AA conference, 20% of you didn't want to come, right? That's my average, I think, yeah. But you told somebody you'd drive or you had to host a speaker or something, and all of a sudden you're roped into being here, right? And that's grace, right? Because we get to do this fellowship. We get to relate to each other. We get to grow spiritually. And my brother said, I said, I got to get past you because I want that gun. And he didn't know. He said, no, you don't. I said, I have to get past you. And he said the sentence that my sponsor says is the most spiritual sentence in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, get in the car. Right. Right. And I did. I had no choice. And I want to tell you, the scariest day of my life was when he actually took me to my parents because they had to sign some paperwork. They took me out to the desert to this rehab. And the scariest day of my life was walking in there. Anybody know what the second scariest day of my life was? Walking out. Because walking in there, I'm terrified. I don't have my medicine, right? I'm not really sure I actually agreed to any of this, you know. And I go in there. Actually, a guy took a picture of me, and he weighed me. He gave me that picture when I left. He said, you are not this man anymore. Keep this. I gained 47 pounds in that hospital. My body was like, thank you, Jesus, you're eating food, you know. I slept at night. You know, I did these really awkward things for me, you know. And I didn't do a lot. I don't remember much from the hospital because I was out of it. I'd really abused myself, but I was there for 30 days, and then my brother picked me up and took me home, and he threw me out of the car. He didn't throw me. He pulled up and said, go to a meeting. And I remember thinking, these AA guys, they're so intense, you know. I've been in a hospital for 30 days. A very fine rehab, thank you very much. I got insurance. I can make it through a day without going to. But I lied all the time, and I said, yeah, of course. So he'd leave. And I went up to my apartment, and the door was unlocked, which was weird. And there was a party in my apartment. There were girls with very small bikinis on, snorting cocaine off my glass table. There was music I didn't like being played on my speakers. I didn't know anyone. And I lived there by myself. But some of my lower companions got the word out that I was out of town. And there was a party. It was pot smoke and girls and cocaine. All my favorite Olympic events are happening. And I walk in, and somebody hands me a beer. Yeah, it actually wasn't a beer. It was a Coors. right? And I'm standing there, and if you're new, I want to tell you what I did. I turned around. I went outside. I put the beer on my porch, and I sprinted away. And I didn't do that because I had a foundation of recovery. I didn't. I didn't do that because I had a connection to a higher power. I did that because I had a moment of grace, and it was another thought. I looked around this room and thought, you got nothing. You got nothing. Like, my guitars are gone. Half my stuff's gone. I don't know. It was so alien being in my apartment with strangers. When I'd lived there alone for months, nobody came in. And it was so clear I had nothing left. I didn't have character or self-respect. I didn't have many prospects. But I did think for a second, hey, man, the one thing no one can take away from you is 30 days. You got 30 days. And if you got a year or 6 months or 90 days or 22 days and you lied and said you had 30 days today, we get it. But those days should be the most precious things you've got, right? So I ran out of that apartment because I had one thing left on earth, and it wasn't material. And I ran to a payphone, and I called AA. This is such a weird story, the way this unfolded. I ran 3 blocks to this payphone. I called AA, and I kind of barfed on the guy. Like, yeah, I was a rock star, and a Coors, and a baby, and my mom got cancer. And he's like, what? What's going on? And I said, I can't go home. I don't know what to do. And he goes, this is a true story. He goes, where are you? And I go, I'm on the corner of Burl and Redondo Beach Boulevard. And he goes, that's weird. I said, why is that weird? He said, there's an AA meeting right across the street from where you're standing. Starts in 20. Grace! Grace! It's everywhere, right? And I actually said, I go, so what do you think I should do? You know, like, I did. Because I'm like, that's awesome. I explained that I have unique problems, you know. Send a therapist and a car and a bottle of water. I'm in trouble. And the guy's like, I'd love to meet this guy. He goes, you should go to that meeting, you know. And So I'm going to just hurry up. I went to that meeting. I didn't hear a thing. When I went to leave, I had to have nowhere to go. And one of my brother's friends walked by and goes, "Hey, I heard you're Neil's little brother, right?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I heard you look like crap." And I said, "Well, I've been working on myself. I've been sleeping and eating, you know." And he goes, "Can I take you home?" And I actually ran to my first AA meeting. I should have some plaque or something for that, right? So I go out to his car, and I won't tell him where I live. Anyway, through a series of events, he drove me to my parents' house. And I want to talk about something here. If you're newish, we have our perception, right? And my perception was, I cannot be dropped off at my parents' house tonight. My mother and father love each other. They've been married at that time for 45 years. My mother is terminally ill. My father is beside himself with fear and sadness. Their loser son, fresh out of rehab with an illegitimate child across town, is not showing up on their porch tonight. It's the worst possible thing. That's my perception. It's going to be embarrassing for them. It's humiliating for me. I was playing at CBGB's a year and a half ago, right? Now I'm going to go to my mom's and dad's house after rehab. And this guy just dropped me off at my parents' house. And I live in Torrance, California. And if you've ever been to Torrance, California, all that's there is parents' house. Like block after block of parents. And so there's no way for me to run off to. And I'm standing on the porch. Just more, I didn't mean to give all this detail, but hadn't been there in 7 months. And I knocked and I waited. My mom was strapped to oxygen and my parents are from Illinois. They go to the door together. And I wanted to get out of there, but I looked down and there was a guitar pick with my signature on it on the porch. And I hadn't been there in months. And my parents were fastidious. My father was in the military. My mother was I kept the house clean. And I was mesmerized. And then my dad and mom opened the door. And they were glad to see me. So glad. It escaped from them. You know, my perception is so polluted with my fear, my guilt, my anticipation, my history, that I can't see perfect reality. It's always perfect. Reality is perfect. The reason I know grace is always around me is because I only miss it when I'm in the bondage of self. I've been watching it all day long, right? So I go into my parents' house, and they gave me my old bedroom. I walk in there, there's the poster of Eric Clapton that I put up there when I was 12. And I said, "Hi, Eric, I'm back." So because I lived at my parents' house, I just went to a meeting every morning, noon and night, because they made me nervous, because they were loving and kind and forgiving, and I didn't think I deserved it. They were just nice. I finally said to my dad, I go, "Dad, why was that pick on the front porch?" And he goes, "You know, you hadn't been here a long time, and when you left, you pulled your keys out, and I saw it fell off out of your pocket. And I just couldn't pick it up because I missed you so much." And I took care of my mother. I lived with my parents. I was holding my mother when she died. I worked with them. I went to meetings all the time. I got a lame AA job. Then I got a better AA job. I got to tell you, I may go 6 minutes. But I got a job at Qantas because I remember the guy, the vice president of the airline's name when he was visitor at the meeting. He came back and I remembered his name and he gave me a job. That's grace. I didn't hustle him for a job. I tried to welcome him back to a meeting. I went to this meeting. I just bought a guitar. I couldn't show anybody because nobody trusted me because I got hired by the vice president. And I didn't drink and chase women. So I went out to the bus stop, and I'm standing at the bus stop, and this woman from British Airways comes up, and I go, "Hey, can I show you this guitar I just bought?" I didn't know her. And she turns to me, and she goes, "I don't look at strange men's guitars." And I was like, "Whatever, lady. Like, I'm not that strange. You know, I have my uniform on." But she thought I was hitting on her. And I was going to say, "Lady, trust me, I'm not hitting on you. I live with my parents and I go to AA. And I have a baby. Want to have dinner?" You know? So, like, women are safe when I'm here, you know? So I got on the bus and we were smushed against each other. Right? And she's nervous now because it's really crowded. And she had a book in her hand called Surprised by Joy. By C.S. Lewis, and I've read that book. And I said, "Oh, I've read that book. What do you think?" And she goes, "Well, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God?" And I about spit on her. I go, "God saved my life." You know? And she's like, oh, shit, I got to get away, you know. And she goes, "Well, I don't believe in God." And I go, we talked about God. And as we were talking about God, and we're 20-minute drive to the employee bus cars, I'm like, God, she's so lovely. And there's this energy between us. I've never felt more home in my life. And that's called a spiritual awakening, honestly. I didn't start lying about who I was. I just enjoyed talking to her. And we got off the bus. I started to go back to my car, and I thought, Matthew, this is never going to happen again. And I ran back, and I said, hey, you want to have dinner sometime? And boy, did she not want to have dinner with me, you know. Oh, right, look at my guitar and this beautiful British accent. I've read that book, and she's attacking me now. And I said, hey, no is the complete answer. Because I've been doing steps. I've been showing up. I'm paying the money back. I did a fifth step. I'm taking commitments. I don't hate my company anymore. And I said, no is the complete answer. And she said, okay, no. And that surprised her. And I said, well, I think we're missing something here. I went home to my dad. He waited up for me every night. And I said, Dad, I met a girl and she felt like home. And he said, wow, tell me about that. And we're walking down the hall that night. He was going back to my mom and I was going to my bedroom. And he put his hands on my back and he rubbed my back and said, that's not over, son. I'm like, Dad, you did not hear. It's over. Yeah. So I went to work the next day and I realized I'd grown spiritually because I didn't tell anybody she was a lesbian. Right? Like, that's her business. It's not my business. I had a girl come up to me at the Pacific Palisades and go, I'm a lesbian. I go, that's great. She goes, you know how I know? And I go, no, how? She goes, I'm not attracted to you. But I went to work seriously and I walked up to the bus stop hoping I wouldn't see her. And she came up and tapped me on the shoulder and she said, hey, I was rude to you last night. I said, that's okay. And she said, I'm never going to go out with you. I said, wow, you've been so perfectly clear about that. Yeah. And she said, but if you want to miss this bus, I'll have coffee with you. And 2 weeks later, she proposed to me, and we've been married for 30 years. Bam! That's right. Right? Grace! Miracles happen here. I converted a lesbian. Right? Everybody's so uncomfortable. Everybody except the lesbians are cringing right now. But anyway, I just want to finish with this. I've never loved anyone as much as I love Philippa Jane Headley Clark. I've loved her for 30 years. We parented Phoebe with Anna. And when Anna was going off to college, which is kind of embarrassing, you know, and Phoebe was a year old, I'd been paying child support because my sponsor said, don't tell me you love your daughter, show me you love your daughter. And I said, Phoebe, I'm going to be your dad for the rest of your life. And a year before that, I'd said, God, make it so these two people never meet this guy again. And that guy has never met those women again because of you, because of direction. And then my wife and I had children of our own. And you know who was at the hospital? Anna and Phoebe. As soon as we got there, they were waiting for us. Then we adopted a child. But I want you to know, just like everybody shared, you know, people come up here like, I used to rob banks and now butterflies come out of my butt. You know, it's like I got sober and like I'm perfect. You know, my life is my life. I have every challenge everybody else has had. My wife and I have had many challenges. 23 years ago, she had a massive stroke. And I've been taking care of that woman for 23 years. She's completely paralyzed on her left side and she's brain damaged. But I can tell you this, she's the caregiver. I do everything that takes two arms and two legs and a memory. We adopted that child after she became disabled. You know, somebody said it earlier, but, you know, people walk up to you in AA when you're new, I'm going to finish, and they say, everything's going to be all right. They are lying to you. I'm here to clear that up. But I can tell you what they're trying to say, and Liz's whole talk was about it. What they're trying to say is if you come here and you actually do this work and you stay close, no matter what happens, you're going to be all right. And that's my story. Thanks for letting me share.